Good evening. It's a pleasure to be at the Vale tonight, and thank you very much to Paul for the invitation. The poems that I'm going to read tonight are from my debut collection. As you heard in the introduction, it's called How to Lose Your Home and Save Your Life. And it draws on events from the past 5-6 years, experiences that will be familiar to many, redundancy, unemployment, financial instability, and in addition to which, shortly after I lost my job, my bank made a mistake with my home loan, which meant everything was suddenly on the line. Any other time, the mistake might have been spotted and fixed, but this was 2008, and although none of us realised it at the time, we were standing on the edge of an abyss. The tiger's tail. City, a howl of chemical laughter. Menace fingers the air, seeking purchase in the drunken smoulder of narrow streets. Young girls toss iron curtains of ebony hair, shared tribal headdress. Tiger sucklings, knock-kneed, moon-eyed calves, they perch on the heights of borrowed triumph. Prada, Miu Miu, Louboutin. Fierce children, almost feral, wresting frenzied joy from the teeth of new calamity. Night yawns deep, and they do not know it. Car headlamps sweep the junction, horns blare. Ground shifting beneath them again, the girls totter into the bloom of darkness, each on milky limbs, pale and slender as a birch. So for about 2 years, I tried to get the bank to engage with the mistake and sort out the mistake that we'd made. First they ignored me, then they threatened me. Then they apologised, and then they denied everything. So I just found myself getting deeper and deeper entrenched into this situation that I had done nothing to create. Occupied. White slab on the doormat. Postmark, a familiar China blue. The forfeit of dignity in monthly increments, and I'm sick to my stomach again. And on TV, occupying Wall Street, as though greed were a discovery, injustice a shiny toy, or the new black. I've been in my foxhole for 3 years now, dug in behind enemy lines, terraced walls, the polite exterior of war. Wrestling the slick of their machinery, bare hands ink-blooded in daily skirmishes with quicksand bureaucracy. And you, with the placard, the ironic slogan, where the fuck were you? So up to this point, I thought I knew what my life was about. I was a good girl. I did everything that you're supposed to do. I went to school, I studied hard, I went to university, I trained as an architect. And I found myself in this place of uncertainty because I'd followed the script and it failed. And the question I was left with is, what happened then? Junkie. iPod, laptop, coffee machine, never used. Good for €50, maybe more. Not to be sniffed at. Enough to store probiotic yogurt. 3 weeks worth of Lexapro. Prescribed, of course. You're nothing without your health. Sweating, nerves buzzed. I trip rain-blacked streets. Flash electrical goods at likely marks. P people who still care about appearances. Don't judge me. I wasn't born this way. I blame my parents, the ones who weaned me on this crippling addiction to comfort, pushing food, money, education as security. So when the world takes my roof, I learn to crave a roof. And when the world takes my land, I learn to crave land. When the world takes my voice, I learn to crave a voice. And when the world takes my power, I learn to crave power. My parents should have raised me a gypsy, shown me the road, the cut of the air, the smell of dirt. I smell it now. It's close. So what I realized along the way is that for all of this, it's completely impersonal for the bank. You know, you're just a box that they're ticking, another letter that they're sending out. It means nothing to them. But for every person who's on the receiving end of that, it's deeply personal. It's everything that matters to them. It's a difficult thing to keep railing against that wall of impersonal indifference. And at some point, something's got to give. The talking cure. The day I pull my face together, paint lash and liner, the ordinary mask, is predictably the day you make me cry, as if the smudge of black across my lids is just the beginning, a surface schism. You draw me like a rotten tooth, another battle-blooded version of myself, raw and tentacled, untethered. And as you show me the extraction, hold me up and turn me over, I hang there and sit here, all tear-stung, throaty, bile-burn, oozing, rust-rivered, black-eyed jangle, and poke the ragged opening with my tongue. So, because of all of this, I was kind of tied to Ireland, and being an architect, that was kind of a miserable situation to find myself in. But equally for other people in my profession who were able to leave, they were also challenged by this uncertainty and sudden change. The emigrant's tale. As the plane dips into the mist on Dublin Bay, you are startled to find yourself in tears. 4 years and such a rude departure. The passenger next to you asks if you're okay. Later, you sit across from me at a table in one of the old haunts. Unravel lost time. Job gone one month, you the next. Gone from a home, from friends and a life. You tell me how you went back to Cape Town. Trod the boardwalk at Sea Point, trying to make sense of it all. How your life slowed to the steady pace of your footsteps, one foot in front of the other, focused only on their progress, the weight and shift, anxious not to be still, and thinking, African sun on your back, then your face. 6 months pass, and a friend confronts you, tells you it is time to stop walking. You try to make it home again, but it is too late. your restless feet belong to the world now. We talk of your new life in Riyadh, the sand, the Sahara, your new boss, his pride in you, his professional Western woman, things you miss, trousers, driving, a double bed. We hug and part at the top of Cow's Lane, you slight and bundled in a new winter coat. You'd forgotten how cold this country is. And as we turn onto Dame Street, it seems to me you hesitate, small and lost in the boom of rush hour traffic. Evening light blossoms pink on the rooftops of Trinity, and I wonder if it's made you cry again. And all of this experience kind of made me more aware of abuse of power, not simply what we were experiencing right about us, but also examples from the past. And I came across a painting by Norman Rockwell. It's called The Problem We All Live With, and it depicts the first black child entering a desegregated school in the US in 1960. It's a beautiful picture and quite disturbing at the same time. I kind of got drawn in by the image of this beautiful little black girl, and then once you start to see the details around it, you realise there's something much more disturbing going on. So that made me curious about the painting and the story behind it. Ruby Bridges goes to school. You marched like a little soldier that November morning in New Orleans, through mobs and missiles, only 6 years old, white dress, white shoes, white ribbon in your hair. Carried a yellow ruler to measure the distance between black and white. An exercise book to calculate division, a sum that will never add up. Already schooled in the lessons of hatred, the bitterness of geography, of economics, of history. You sat in the empty classroom and learned to ignore the black doll in the coffin by the school gate and the threat of poison, to forgive those who fired your father, threw your grandparents off their land, pointed fingers, screamed, taunted, refused to serve you at the grocery store. The only teacher who would take you met you with a hug at the open door, sat next to you at your wooden desk, jump-jacked and danced with you at recess. When you asked her, Mrs. Henry said, "It's not easy for people to change. They're used to the world a certain way. Some are afraid. They don't know better." Each day you walked up the school steps, whispered your prayers, courage to keep their fear at bay. So after 4 years, I'd been through the whole process of trying to get the bank to fix the mistake. I spent another 2 years going through the Financial Services Ombudsman process, equally without joy. So my final recourse was to go to the High Court, and I discovered that I could do that myself as a lay litigant. So I wasn't prepared to hand over my home on the basis of somebody's incompetence, so I took the challenge to the High Court. This is part of a long poem, which is my very first time rolling up at the High Court with absolutely zero legal knowledge. I'm just going to read the first part of it tonight. litigation for beginners. I clasp and unclasp the briefcase with muggy hands in the back of the taxi. Note its faint smell of mould. On Church Street at the Lewis, a group of barristers cross with lights, knives in black, sharp, polished. I feel sick. My stomach heaves, acid reflux sours and burns my throat. Later, I wonder what their collective noun might be. An assassination of barristers, a pomposity, a hiding, a ditch. Two photographers loiter on the quays outside the forecourts. I wobble past, self-conscious, trousers shrunk from washing, my ankles scream at passers-by, feet swollen, and these the only shoes that fit, glued back together in a panic this morning. Now staccato down a long, cold hallway, echo-corniced ceiling, stone walls and floor. I am monstrous, conspicuous as a giraffe. Under the landmark dome, the foyer brims with clients and barristers, boxes and briefcases, bombast and fear. I am alone here. I don't know what happens next. Sit first, breathe. Minutes shred. I turn to my neighbour and ask, are we called in one by one? He's puzzled. You're a solicitor? I hide my feet. Lay litigant. An eyebrow, a flicker, the briefest recoil. No, he says, we all go in together. So eventually I'd got a court date and was all set to go for that, and just beforehand I discovered a lump. CAT scan. A crawl wind catches and I trip past gatepost guardians, the turn of railings into the hospital grounds. Hypodermic drinks darkness deep, shows it to the light. An apple skin can never know its core. In the sting of a burnished room, glass and disinfectant hold me safe and distant. The scratch of gown makes me smaller than I am. A cracked voice cuts into the hollow of the machine as it spins and slices me like ham. Don't worry, it says. You're almost done. Inside the blink and grind, the growl of plastic, deep and still. I see a field in the half-light of summer's dusk. Grasp a long feathered grass, the nub of its soft head, wet like a kiss. Three black lines track to another somewhere, past the house and barn. Their cut silhouette, gentle, an inevitable homecoming. I find a face in a tree there. Black eyes and truffle snout, mouth agape in silver skin. I hold its gaze in the drizzle of darkness, humming to myself, the tree bends to listen. I hum the song again in the quiet room where they tell me, spinning the tree, grass, night, through and through my fingers. Back out on the street, the wind shifts. I brace for the oncoming squall. So you'd be pleased to hear that it was benign, the lump was benign, but it was a scare and a jolt, and it made me realise how much of my time in the past 6 years had gone into this impossible situation, one where I had no modicum of control at all, and it made me realise that there were other experiences still to be had, and a balance that I needed to find. Crows. When the crows, with their gimlet eyes, count your bones and weigh them, empty your skeleton of meat, claw cartilage, hook eyelids with oily beak, peck at your tongue, pluck out your hair, make a perch of your skull, crook claws tapping, black wings beating at your sleep. Stop. Take off your shoes. Walk out into the wet field and plant one foot into the rain-churned loam. Let the black earth's chill ooze between your toes and pluck the taut string to your gut. Hold you, make you burn for release. Plant the other foot in wet grass. Feel the borrowed rain fumble new pathways across your skin. Watch the soft evening light discover itself after the rain. Breathe in the smell of earth in everything, of green in everything. Breathe in the oxygen spark of redemption, the crackling air. Breathe. Remember, this is living. So as things stand at the moment, my case has gone to the Supreme Court. It will be several years before I find out what happens. And what I've had to come to terms with is that sometimes there are no answers, or at least sometimes you just have to make up your own. What happened through all of this is that I started writing about it because it was the only place where I could have any sense of control or the ability to shape the events and make something meaningful out of them. Ash Wednesday. I wake to the half-remembered words of a song turning like pages in my head. Rooftops and papers in the roadside. I think of Eliot's Preludes, scour the bookshelves and seize a paperback that falls wide to a marked page. Ash Wednesday. Because I do not hope to turn again. Because I do not hope. Because I do not hope to turn. Lunchtime at the gallery, the laureate speaks of a gift born on a sudden wind. How to grasp surprise as it alights, ready to hold and work it like clay. Of mothers, of kites, of poems that dream of being Bruegels and Vermeers. Walking back along Nassau Street, I hear a woman close behind say, "Oh, but just to hear him speak." In the cafe, an overly bright couple break bread, words, and other brittle things. I wrestle with surprise, and it too breaks. A spoonful of rum-drenched dessert is across my lips before I remember the part about fasting and abstinence. Years of benediction bristle, but I cannot find it in me to repent this or any other moment's joy. Later, my mother calls, asks if I remember what day it is. As if I were still a child under the thumb of a priest. I answer stoutly, yes, then turn the page. before another question can give lie to my place of worship. What matter if it is the dulb of words, bright, the beat of wings, sudden and joyful, that place their mark upon me today? And what matter, anyway, the place, when before place, before time, before all, in the beginning, alone, was the Word. Thank you. This is my last poem. I'd just like to say thanks again to Paul and to everyone tonight for this evening. I'm going to leave you with a childhood memory. That's all been a bit grim up until now. I think children have a very clear sense of who they are and what they want out of life. So I'm going to take you back to the six-year-old Angela, who knew exactly what she was about. Good practice for girls. As a child, I used to pop the heads off dolls, looking aside, intrigued by puncture marks in neat rows, the stitched hair tufts, always blonde, a peachy cave with rubber walls, and the blink of glass eyes rolling back to nothing. Even then, their emptiness displeased me, and headless they remained, lined up like trophies on the garden shed. Despite this, or perhaps because, I heard Mum tell Aunt Rose, dolls are good practice for girls. On holiday in Donegal, she'd press each hostess to hand their precious offspring to my reluctant care. And for an hour or two, against the foil of tea, cake, and doilies, an indignant standoff ensued. Two plump, scowling stares. One charge peed on me, a rosy Buddha child who hit the floor with surprising bounds. My mother, a beacon, shame enough to light to our bag. It's supposed to be lucky, Rose said. My favourite toy was the shiny beetle. I'd race up and down the driveway with the boys, yellow bonnet glinting in the sun as I brummed my way to victory. And the swing Dad made from old scaffold poles, where for hours I'd kick my feet against the sky, limbs swimming, words dancing like dappled light through my giddy head. Though to infinity. Thank you very much.